state.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef, available on the internet at HearstRanch.com.
Well, hello. My name's Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and this is Chef Story. In fact, it's the very first radio Chef Story on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, and we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, as we will every Wednesday at noon. And we have a special guest today. Chef Story is going to be interviewing chefs all over from all over the world. And for our debut program, I am just thrilled and honored to have my mentor and probably the inspiration for Chef Story here with me today, none other than Jacques Pepin. Hello, Jacques.
Hello, Dorothy. That's very, very nice of you.
Oh, well, no. You know, Chef Story was a PBS series,
yes.
And you helped me get that on the ground. I think
yes.
Inside the Actors Studio came to us and wanted to do something for chefs, and you did a pilot with us, and you said, turned around and said, if that's going to be the show, Dorothy, I don't want to be on it.
Yeah.
and then we brought in the pros who help on your show, Susie Heller, and we really got a great show going. So if you've ever seen it on PBS, it's not on PBS any longer, but we did 27 chefs and it was great. And Jacques was on that show too. But now we're going to do the radio format of it. And we're going to get into the lives of chefs, the philosophies of chefs, and maybe a lot more. So Jacques, we're going to start with you this morning. And as people know, for 25 years, we've been working together. You're a dean at the International Culinary Center.
Mm-hmm.
Most people know it as the French Culinary Institute, but we've grown, and so we're the International Culinary Center. And yesterday, we had a huge photo shoot there, and we have chefs Cesare Casella for the Italian chef and Chef Jose Andres as the Spanish chef.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all the chefs wrapped in flags.
Yes.
And we tried to wrap you in a French flag, which you took for a little bit, but you grabbed the American flag, and you insisted on being wrapped in the American flag. And it really touched my heart, because I know when you were a young boy growing up in Burgundy, you grew up during World War II,
mm-hmm.
and you got bombed a lot. And as you said to me, it was the Americans who were bombing you. And so how does that play in your life?
Well, I also remember that at the Liberation, running after the American tank, you know, and the GI throwing us chocolate and chewing gum, which of course I never had in my life. I think the first chewing gum that I had with my brother, we kept it for 3 months, giving it to our friend, he would test it, giving it back to us, and so forth. And the chocolate, which I have had, I suppose, before the war, when I was really an infant, I didn't remember the taste, so for all purpose, this was the first chocolate that I've had. So I do remember that as a kind of thing with essential in my gustatory life, you know, the life of a chef.
Fond memories. For people who haven't read your wonderful book, The Apprentice, it talks about you starting in kitchens at 15 and your mother was a chef and had a restaurant.
Right.
But going back, I'd like to explore those war years a little more, because you don't really talk about it in your book. What kind of food were you eating? You were in Burgundy and you were in the farmlands, mm-hmm. but did you have all the food that you needed? What was your food
life then? We did not. I mean, my father left, I think it was the year of 1953, to go into the French Resistance. My mother was a waitress. I had a brother a year and a half older than me and one 4 years younger than me. So she really struggled a great deal to find food for us. And she had a bicycle. I still remember that bicycle because the tire were not inflated inside. It was just solid pieces of rubber. And she would do like 30, 40, 50 kilometers, you know, over the weekend, going from one farm to the other, trying to get food. And that wasn't an easy, and she did a lot herself. I mean, I remember the only sugar that we had during the war was sugar that she made with beets. She made a syrup, you know. She became very, very talented. Well, she was a talented cook, but at using anything that you can imagine from, you know, a different type of herb that we grow wild and two that she pick up. And that's probably where I got my very miserly attitude, you know, in the kitchen. I cannot throw anything out.
No, well, that's a proper thing. I mean, respect the food.
Yeah, it's
so
true.
But what kinds of things was she buying on the farm? Was it vegetables or
She could get a couple of eggs, half a jar of jam, some lard, some fat, anything that she could get, you know, or exchange and all this. I remember at some point I was put in a school there, which we're not supposed to have. It was a Jesuit school, so they were very, very tough. And I wasn't supposed to be in there because I was too young, but they made a favor, accepted me with my older brother. And in that farm, there was a fair amount of kids whose parents were farmers. So they had a jar of like salted fat, salted lard, and another one, a jar of honey, another one stuff that their parents sent. We had a piece of bread that we got every day, and we banged it on the table, I remember, because usually it was full of little critter, you know, who came out of the
no.
bread. It was
maggots?
Dry, oh yes. So anyway, but it didn't disturb us. We banged the bread, and then after we used it. And I remember perfectly one day that I came begging for food to one of them with my piece of bread, so they put salted lard on one side, and then I turn it upside down, go back to the other one for the other side, and I got like, I don't know, raspberry jam or whatever on the other side. It didn't work out, but I become very proficient at begging for food.
My gosh. So how long was your father in the resistance, and how long was it from the time you would see him? Would he ever come back and see you? Or?
Well, that's a good point, too, because we were bombed three times, because we lived next to the railroad station in Bourg-en-Bresse. And the first time, it was actually the Italian. Who tried to bomb the railroad station and actually blow the part of our house. No one was there. We were at the garden with my grandmother. And then the second time was the American, actually, who tried to bomb the thing. And the third time was the German. When they left, they blew out the bridge. Three times that house was damaged. Three times we had to evacuate and go to some cousin. But to make a long story short, my father, who was in the resistance, remember at the time we had no telephone, nothing, no way of communicating. So he would appear in town with a couple of cans of sardine or whatever he could get for us and go to the house, and the house was not there or destroyed. So he has to find out that some cousin, whatever. But no one ever got hurt, you know, so we were very lucky.
So he was hiding out all the time.
And you would
never know when he was going to appear.
No, you couldn't know. He was with a bunch of friends in the mountain. And one time he came to town and he got arrested by the police because his shoes were full of mud. He didn't realize. Say, you come from the country, where were you? And they put him in, again, the wall in the prefecture of the police. They are like the police station. And he stayed there like 8 hours with like six or seven other guys that they are picked up. They eventually took two that they shot there, and the other one they let go. So you never knew where would go, you know.
So. Oh, my. So was your mother working in a restaurant during the war? Were there restaurants during the war?
She was a waitress, yes.
Ah.
And she started this way and started learning how to cook better from the chef and eventually opened her own restaurant. And at the end of the war, she already had her own restaurant.
So how old were you when the war ended?
Well, I was 9 years old, ten years old.
Ten years old, at
the end of 35 years. So.
So do you think those years really formed one of your attractions to food in a major way?
Certainly, in many ways, you know, this is kind of very insidious, you know, the way things come in or the way change as you get older and so forth. But certainly those first memory as a child, those first taste, those restrictions and all that, yes, I think stay with you the rest of your life.
So then at 15, you were working in some grand restaurants when you were a teenager. And how... How was that? What was your, how were your eyes opened through the restaurants?
Well, actually it was 13 and a half when I left home. But when I left home, my mother already had a restaurant in Lyon called Chez Pépin, you know, a small family restaurant. And prior to this, I still remember going to the market in the morning with my mother. We didn't have a car at the time. And along the Saône River in Lyon, there is the market to start at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's about a mile long with all the farmers. So it may sound kind of romantic now, but for my brother and I, it wasn't. You know, we had to carry each one a big bag, and my mother would walk the market one way and buy on the other way. Buying off a crate of mushroom, because those mushrooms were dark too, and they know they couldn't sell it the day after, so she bought it just at the limit to buy it for half price or less, because then get back to the restaurant, start peeling her vegetable and start cooking for the day. And every day it was the same thing. We had no refrigeration, remember, so we had a glacière, which was, you know, an ice box, really a block of ice. And so she had some fish and the meat that she had, but that was for the day. The day after, you had to have something else. So there, the food had to be fresh, because there was no choice anyway. There was no freezer.
Right. So what was the first cuisine restaurant that you worked in?
Well, when I left home, I worked at the Hôtel de l'Europe in Bourg-en-Bresse for my apprenticeship. And for me, that was certainly a grand restaurant. It was, and the executive chef there, Paul Jauget, actually had been to school with my mother when they were a kid. But he addressed me as petit, you know, petit, like kid. You know, he never addressed me as my name, Jacques, until after a year of apprenticeship, I was allowed to go to the stove. For a year, you do a lot of cleaning, a lot of menial thing, cleaning up, and they send you back and forth, and all of a sudden they say, you start at the stove tomorrow. I said, me? I don't know what to do. And you start at the stove. So our learning was through osmosis. You know, you're next to one, because the chef never told you anything. If he tell you do this, if you had said, you wouldn't even think of it, but if you had said why, he would have said, because I just told you. That was about the end of the explanation, so you did, and eventually learned through a type of osmosis, and you start at the stove. And which brings us to a point, like yesterday, I think André Saltner was talking about, after 3 years of apprenticeship, you know, working really hard, we would never have been able to do what the student do at the French Culinary Institute after 6 months. No way. However, we were probably much faster with our hand and all that, because we did those type of... But that was the way apprenticeship was.
So tell me, in very short order, you were made the chef at the Élysée Palace, which is the White House of France, and you cooked for Charles de Gaulle.
Right.
At what age was that? And well, what was that like?
I was 21 there. But I had started, as I say, from age 5, 6, but formal apprenticeship, age 13. I finished my apprenticeship. I work in Aix-les-Bains, in a seasonal place for the season, and work in Lyon, and eventually work in a place, L'Arbrel, which is near Geneva, where I took the job as the chef for the winter. I was 17 years old.
Ooh.
And the point is that there was a chef there, but the winter was very, very quiet, so he used to do the season in the ski area, so they took someone like me, and I was, quote, the chef for the winter.
I see.
And after that, then I left and went to Paris. So I had been working in Paris at the Plaza Athénée, Maxime, Fouquet's, some of the great restaurants of Paris by the time I was 21, you know. So,
What was it like cooking for Charles de Gaulle?
Well, you know, to start with, the role of the chef and certainly the position of the chef are quite at the antipode, you know, at the opposite of what they are today. I mean, we were really at the bottom of the social scale, and any good mother would have wanted her child to marry an architect, a lawyer, or a doctor, certainly not a cook, which now, of course, we are genius, so it's quite different. But at that time, you work in the back kitchen. I mean, I was alone as a chef, and I serve only 6 or 8 people a day. Then I had the dishwasher. Then I asked, I said, I need a pastry chef. That's when I met Claude. My friend Jean-Claude came and worked for me or with me. And during that time, as I said, we served really never more than 10, 12 people at the most, usually 4 or 5, just the first family. And on Sunday, the Dominical meal, you know, after church, for example, the goal, we are very, you know, religious, and they went to school, to a church every Sunday. And then there was the family meal after children, grandchildren, and so forth. And those type of meal, then of course the menu would be decided by Madame de Gaulle. I spoke with her during the week, and she said, I want you to do that. Or I want a, usually very simple, straightforward, you know, a gratin of potato with, you know, maybe a leg of lamb, then a quiche to start, and maybe a caramel custard. But the best quality of what you could find, the cheese and all that, you know, simple, good food. As it came to state dinner, you know, I served people like Eisenhower and Nehru, Tito, Macmillan, which were the head of state at the time. Usually you'd work it out with the protocol, because if when Eisenhower came, for example, then he invited de Gaulle to the American embassy, and then after they may have a dinner at the Quai d'Orsay in Paris, so you don't want to have three times the same fish. So basically the protocol is going to synchronize. You give them some suggestion, but they tell you, depending also whether the menu is very important, whether it's a long menu, whether it's a shorter one, and so forth. So that's usually decided by the protocol. And if no one come, no one ever came in the kitchen, and if ever someone came in the kitchen, it was usually to complain about something. So it was good if no one came.
When you say a long menu back then, how long was a long menu? How many courses?
It could be 7 courses. It could be about 2.5 hours.
It's not French Laundry, little 3-bite courses.
No. That did not exist at the time.
No.
It did not exist at the time. The service on plate did not exist at the time. Remember that we don't have that until the mid-70s when Nouvelle Cuisine came about. I mean, that's one thing.
So wait. Explain that. So you didn't have food coming out of the kitchen already plated?
No, absolutely not.
So that, how was it served?
Well, people think that Nouvelle Cuisine is over. This is maybe one of the biggest legacy of Nouvelle Cuisine. When I work at the Pavilion in New York, everything was on platter. My mother's restaurant, which was really a tiny, inexpensive restaurant, if she cooked a whiting or a piece of fish, it was on a plate, on a platter, rather, brought to the table, and people put it in their plate. Even at home, on Sunday, my mother would not even plate the food. No one knew. She would put a dish or a roast in the center of the table, the vegetable, and you help ourselves. I've never seen once someone bringing a plate of food to someone until Nouvelle Cuisine exploded. And now, I mean, you have no chef who don't serve anything on plate, you know. So that's one of the legacy of Nouvelle Cuisine people don't realize. So there certainly the service was either à la française or à l'anglaise, that is, with the waiter going around to the guest, you know. And à la française would be you present the dish to the person and the person help herself or himself, and à l'anglaise would be the waiter grab it with 2 forks or spoon and serve it to you in your plate.
Ooh, it's a good thing we don't do that anymore.
No.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back and go into the 1960s and 70s and talk about that.
Oh, boy.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Well, here we are with Jacques Pepin. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton at Chef Story, coming to you live every Wednesday at noon from Roberta's in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. Jacques, we were just talking about your early life, and let's now move up to the 1960s. Today, May 10th, we had a New York Times article that you wrote on Craig Claiborne. And we were just talking about, everyone knows James Beard and Julia Child, but really there was a holy trinity and Craig was part of it. Can you tell us a little bit about Craig Claiborne and what he meant to you?
I would still say that Craig was probably the most influential person in my professional life in America. When I first came here in 1959, I worked at the Pavilion and I met him as he came to do an article on Soule and the Pavilion, and especially Pierre Freinet, who was the executive chef. So I, you know, strike a friendship with Craig. He introduced me to Helen McCauley, who was the food editor on McCall, House Beautiful. Helen was quite well known at the time, and every day she spoke with James Beard for like 2 hours about the condition of the food world. Gossip. That's it, gossip. And so she introduced me to James Beard, and eventually, a few months later, she showed me, she said, I have a manuscript of a book here. Can you take a look at it? Which I looked at, and I said, this looks pretty good. And she said, well, it's a woman from California. She's coming next week to New York, so let's cook for her. It's a really big woman with a terrible voice. You know, and of course, that was Julia. So I knew those people, as you say, the trinity of cooking, within less than a year after I was here, to show you how minusculous, you know, in a sense, the food world was at that time compared to now. So Craig was very, very important. I mean, he single-handedly created the vocabulary of food criticism in America, starting, well, 50 years ago, and the star system of the New York Times, which is still followed now, and make it respectful. I mean, prior to this, you know, the food page was kind of a home economy done. It's kind of very menial or unimportant, certainly, not serious. And he made the world of talking about food, whether it was article or certainly the world of food criticism, you know, powerful. He could be eloquent even in his writing, and respected and so forth. So brought a lot of people into that world.
What were the restaurants like in the 60s compared to today? What was the produce like? What was the, you know?
Well, that was another world. You know, I remember going to the supermarket. For me, I live on 50th and 1st Avenue, and there was D'Agostino Brothers, which was supposed to be a great market. And I remember there was only one salad. That was iceberg. And then I ask, where are the mushrooms? They say aisle 5. That was canned mushroom. You had to go to a specialty store to find mushroom. Now there was no leek, there was no shallot, none of the oriental vegetables. It was really another world. At the Pavilion, certainly, as I work, we get a great deal of the stuff from France. Fish particularly, which was crazy because we have wonderful fish here. Eventually, people would discover, you know, Maine and Long Island and the fish. So, but at the time, and the restaurant, France was much more preeminent French restaurant than they would be now. But the type of French restaurant was kind of snobbish and with a lot of misspelling in the menu for me, who just came from Paris. You know, a lot of misspelling and everything written in French and pretty snobbish and even condescending, you know, to other customers. So it didn't do well to French cuisine. And often, unfortunately, Americans have still that idea of the French cooking, when in fact, you know, the Michelin-style cooking, there is only 23-star Michelin in France, and there is 145,000 restaurants in France. Even people in my family, many of those in France, have never eaten in a three-star restaurant.
Three-star restaurant. Yeah. Well, you know, we've known each other 25 years, right. And you are the least snobby person I know. And I think it was demonstrated, people probably don't know, Le Pavillon was the great restaurant after World War II in New York City. And from Le Pavillon, you went to work at?
At Howard Johnson.
By choice. And you knew Howard Johnson. You want to tell us a little bit about that and why you made that professional decision and how long you were there?
Yeah, interestingly enough, going back to me working for the president in France, I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy. And I had been here not that long, a year, and at the Pavilion. I had started, you know, studying at Columbia University. I started putting my root. I had friends here. And I really didn't want to expatriate myself again from New York to Washington. I did not realize actually the potential of what it was, because as I said, the chef was really at the bottom of the social scale, and never ever would anyone do an article. Well, television barely existed, but radio, so it did not exist. And in fact, the person who took the job, René Verdon, it only started there when Mrs. Kennedy started pushing the chef forward. But prior to him, it was a black lady from the South who had the chef. No one would have ever heard of those people in the kitchen. Mm. You know, now it's totally different. Mm-hmm. So I had that job offer at Howard Johnson. Art Pierre was leaving the Pavilion to work for Howard Johnson. He wanted me to come with him. And it was exciting for me because it was another world of cooking, something that I didn't know anything about it, about American eating habits, about mass production, about chemistry of food. And so it was an exciting thing. And I ended up staying from 1960 to 1970 at Howard Johnson. It was my long
10 years
American apprenticeship.
My
yes.
gosh. Did you enjoy working there?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, I opened a restaurant called La Potagerie in New York with a group of investors, large production. Then I opened the World Trade Center with Joe Baum. Mm-hmm. We had 26 restaurants on the main course, mm-hmm. plus, of course, Window of the World and Skydive on 44th Street. Mm-hmm. I set up the commissary. Then I worked as a consultant for the Russian Tea Room as well. I'm saying that to say that all of those jobs, I could never have done those jobs if I hadn't had the training of Howard Johnson. Mm-hmm. As a chef, coming from France, I would not have known anything about that type of production. So it was very good for me.
You know, when people say, what is Jacques like? I say, he's a true Renaissance man.
Well,
and,
not really.
not really. Wait, we're going to get into his painting. But you also decided at this time to go back. Well, you left home at 13 and a half. You
right.
decided to go to college. You went to Columbia University and wound up with a master's degree in French literature. What made you go back to school? What made you study French literature and have a master's degree in it?
Yes, well, the point is that I already had, like many chefs, starting with Pierre Frenet and all of us, a bit of a complex about not having an education. The chef in France was really working in the kitchen too, so the chef did not open restaurant. It was the maitre d' or people in front of the customer. It was more prestigious. But as I say, the chef itself, so we already had a bit of that type of complex. Well, it was America. I could do whatever I wanted. So I went back. I asked someone, what is the best school? They told me Columbia University, which I'd never heard of. So 3 weeks after I was here, not even 3 weeks, I was enrolled at Columbia into English for Foreign Student, which I went through a couple of years. And I went into a validation program. Eventually, I was accepted into the regular college and did my BA. And eventually, I did a master. And in fact, related to what we are talking, I was doing a PhD. And I basically finished everything except my dissertation. So I am ABD, whatever they call it. But because my dissertation, I proposed an history of French food in the context civilization literature, which is a class that we give at BU now. And at that time, especially in the French department at Columbia, mm-hmm. they say, are you crazy? I mean, food. So that was 1968. Mm-hmm. Last year, I gave the commencement address at Columbia, and I was introduced by the president of Columbia, who said, you know, we refused Jacques Thesis like 40 years ago, which now would be quite acceptable, you know. Mm-hmm. So the world of food has moved into academia, you know, different area, which we didn't
exist before. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we're going to get into the modern day in the next segment. But I just wanted to ask you also about your interest in art. If for those of you who don't know, pick up Jacques' books, because he usually does some of his paintings in those books. He's an incredibly talented painter.
That's true.
Well, you shared with me, and I think this is such an insight. You said to me, Dorothy, I know that I'm a professional chef, and I know I'm not a professional painter. Yeah. Do you remember what you said to me? Can you share that?
I would probably have said, I suppose, that being a professional chef entails first to be a craftsman or a technician. And if you have that knowledge of repeat, really that knowledge of the subject itself, just like a good jeweler or mason or a surgeon for that matter, then you can control the media. And if you happen to have talent with that knowledge in your hand, you can take it somewhere. Well, even if I had some talent in painting, I have none of that craftsmanship. So I start working on a painting, make a mess, get disgusted, throw it out because I don't control the canvas because I haven't spent years and years in studio mixing yellow and blue to make green or controlling the media itself, you know. So,
So I think you also said to me, when your hand knows, you don't even have to tell your hand what to do. When you think something, your hand
yes.
can do it. So you can spend a lot of time thinking about the steps in the future and what you, you know, on a very complicated dish.
It's true. You know, if you repeat and become a great technician, you know, a craftsman in the cooking world I'm talking now, then now you free yourself. That now that you have absorb all of this, it's kind of part of your DNA, so you can let it go. Now you can think in terms of combination of ingredient, in terms of texture, in terms of color, and your hand are just working around. As long as you haven't transcended that level, that menial level, if you want, of craftsmanship, then you cannot move forward. And that's basically what we teach at the school. That is, we prepare the people to become great chef. If they happen to have talent, they will go there. If they don't have talent, they still can run a restaurant.
So how long do you think it takes someone to get that level of proficiency where you're not thinking about it anymore? Because we have all these young chefs coming out of the school, and they want to be a great chef in 2 years.
I know.
And it's a physical thing. How long does that really take to get to your level?
Well, you know, it's like going to school. You know, there is a limitation. If you stop somewhere, you stop somewhere, but you're at that level, period. If you continue learning, then you move on. I mean, without any question, we prepare someone to be able to work in a great kitchen. If that person work with Jean-Georges for 2 years and try to absorb the vision of Jean-Georges von Gerichen and his sense of aesthetic, his sense of taste, then you will have absorbed a lot. Then you do the same thing another 2 years with Thomas Keller if you want, another 2 years with Alfred Portelli or any of the great chefs. And after you have for 5-6 years, whether you agree or not, it's going to be material. After you've done that for 6-7 years, absorb all that amount, you kind of, excuse the pun, but you can regurgitate the whole thing. But now you are going to send it back through your sense of aesthetic, through your sense of taste. Now you start doing your own stuff, you know, but not really before that.
You know, I saw Eberhard Müller not long ago, and he used to be the chef at Le Bernardin when Gilbert Lecoz was alive,
right.
who was the executive chef. And he said he had dinner there recently, and in Eric Repair's food, he could still see Gilbert.
Uh-huh.
I didn't quite understand that. Could you
Could
you let me know how could someone, and Gilbert unfortunately passed away over 10 years ago, and Eberhard could still see the influence. What does that mean?
It means that, you know, totally different now. Now it's the day of egocentrism. I mean, the chefs very often are egocentric, as I said. They want to sign their own dish. They want to make sure that I am the one who did that and so forth. Exactly the opposite of what it was when I worked in Paris or even at the Pavillon. The idea was to conform there. That is, to conform to the style of the house, to do, meaning that there were the famous lobster souffle at the Plaza Athénée in Paris. We were 42 chefs in the kitchen. I think any one of the 42 chefs could have done it, and you would never have known which had done it. Mm. That was the goal, to conform to this. So if you put something on my eyes and put that lobster souffle in front of me, I will test it. I say, oh, that's the lobster souffle of the Plaza Athénée. Or that the sea bass, you know, the sea bass in Vermouth that we did at the Pavillon. So you left those places with those memory of taste in your hand. It's not a question of recipe there. It's a memory of taste. And probably that's what he's talking about, those memory of taste, those essential dishes which define a house, mm-hmm. define the Bernardin, are still there to a certain extent.
Mm. So do you have an iconic dish from your formation years that is really sort of your foundation, or is it mostly technique-based?
As I said, you know, if you could have the greatest bread in the world and the greatest butter in the world, it's hard to beat bread and butter.
That's absolutely
but, true. But I did certainly chicken, you know, because I came from Bourg-en-Bresse, the chicken of Brest in France. So whether it was chicken in Tarragon or simply roast chicken or the poulet à la crème, chicken in cream sauce that my mother used to do, that those tastes are essential and those tastes are ingrained in my brain. And I would recognize my mother poulet à la crème anywhere, you know. So.
Well, We're going to break again here, but we're going to come back and start talking about today's chickens.
Okay.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, welcome back to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we're live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I'm here interviewing the great chef Jacques Pepin. And Jacques has been a dean at the International Culinary Center for 25 years. And quite frankly, when he comes and does his demos, I just say he's the Zen master. To, you know, even an Andre Sultner and Alain Sayek, who are also deans, or any visiting chef, if they come to the school and Jacques is demoing, they stand in the back and they watch. His hands are just amazing. And we're talking to him today about his life and his memories and his formation. But now, Jacques, you've seen it all, and you've watched this food revolution in the United States. And we're talking about we have better products, and there's a lot going on. What's your take on organics? I remember Julia was not a great organic supporter, quite frankly. What is your take on this whole sustainable organic movement?
I don't know if Julia wasn't. I think she was, but she was not against. She refused to close her mind against the modern technology about the possibility of being able to do one thing or another. And I think it's the right attitude. I mean, certainly, for me, as I said, my parents were organic farmers, of course, which the word organic did not exist at the time, but the word fungicide, insecticide, pesticide did not exist, but so chemical fertilizer did not exist either. So we were all organic farmers, and we're just kind of finding that again. And I remember when I first met I went on the West Coast and I was exposed a little bit to organic farmer with Alice Water and all that going too. And people say, we're going to buy in a farm and all that. And they were like a big hoopla. My God, what big thing. And I said, what the big deal? I mean, because of course, we were always, it was always the way it was. I had never been in a supermarket before I came to this country. Supermarket did not exist really. I mean, they didn't exist that long when I came here. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great. Without any question, it's terrific to buy local product, but for me as a chef, I want to buy good product in top of anything else. I mean, whether it's organic or not, if it's lousy, I'm not going to buy it. And it can get exaggerated, as we do always in America. I have been to restaurants where they practically came with a plate to introduce you to the carrot. Her name is Hannah, and she was born on the 7th of December. Said, give me a break, give me the carrot. So it can go a little too far.
However, at Stone Barns, the Blue Hill, they do it quite well because they have vegetables we aren't that familiar with, and they do bring it to the table and sort of educate you. And like little kids, they say, come on, try it. And it opens your eyes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It's, you've watched this whole food movement, and what do you think is the best of it that we're experiencing today, and what do you think is the worst of it? What are we missing that, you know?
Well, the best of it is me sitting here with you and having a radio show, and the prominence of the food world, whether it's radio or whether it's television, it's absolutely amazing. I heard someone on television the other day telling that there was 407 television show on food. I don't know whether it's accurate or not,
oh
but there
gosh.
Is so many channel and all that. Uh-huh. It's just flabbergasting in many ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with that goes all incredible restaurant. I mean, the restaurant at the time of Lutèce, you know, at the beginning, people were there to do it in the 60, they were there to go pre-theater, you know, and to go after. Now the restaurant has become the theater itself. People go there at the theater to be seen, to see the people, to the restaurant, and along the way, the supermarket, along the way, the market, the restaurant, so the whole food world has exploded in an incredible, and it's the newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the New York Times before. There was no food page. Mm-hmm. Now the food page and the book. I mean, 2,600 or 2,800 cookbooks were published last year, mm-hmm. including mine.
Including, how many books have you authored now?
Well, I've done my part, like 27. Or
27,
like
and how many TV series on PBS?
Well, I did the 12 series of 26 shows, you know, we did mostly with KQED, the PBS station in San Francisco. So this is an amazing thing, you know, it permeated the life of everybody and a little restaurant and in that great place we are here in Brooklyn. I mean, you would not have thought of that even 5, 10
years ago. Bushwick, Brooklyn, yeah. For those of you out there who know Bushwick, it's fantastic place, Roberta's. You have to come here. Well, you know what? You were talking before about not taking the job at the White House and you know, being in the basement. But actually, the role of chefs have become so prominent. You've gone through the front door of the White House with your daughter and granddaughter, Shori. Yes, right. Tell us about that.
Well, I did. I went. Actually, you know, I went to the White House several times to see the chef mostly, but I was invited by Barbara Bush when I did that book called The Apprentice. Mm-hmm. And again, that was a big surprise for me. And I'm not trying to be modest because she was involved into a public library.
No, that was Laura Bush.
Laura
right?
Bush.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, you said Barbara, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's so many Bushes, Bush, you know, in the White House.
No, Laura Bush, yeah. And she decided to invite 80 author of the year, and I was one of the 80 authors, which I don't really still understand because they probably say at some point we need someone in the food world, and so I was invited and there for my book The Apprentice, and we signed book there, and it was really a big honor for me. But last year I went back to the White House with Michelle Obama invited me to cook from the organic garden there, and I took it was for the Easter eggs hunt, you know. So, and I went there with my daughter Claudine and my granddaughter Shori, and we cooked crepe and stuffed it with stuff from the garden and strawberry and so forth. Mm. So it was really fun, and it shows again, you know, that at that level. I remember even Alice Water, when Clinton came to bar, called me and just said, "We have to do an organic garden on top of the White House." Mm-hmm. She had lunch with that idea. It never really happened, but I mean, there is, it's in the air, you know, the food is permeating all aspects of life.
You know, do you think America's leading the way about eating intelligently for the 21st century? What's going on in Europe? Do they just eat well, as in the old days? We always had a complex as Americans, or are we eating better now in America?
I think, without any question, America is leading the way in eating.
Really?
In eating, period. Eating well, that's something else.
Okay.
Yeah. We do eat a lot, maybe way too much.
Yes.
I mean, I remember when I was at Howard Johnson, when the first time they introduced a 12-ounce soda, I said, wow, 12-ounce, look at that size of that thing. Mm-hmm. Now you got like 45-ounce soda or plate of food, which is totally ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, I don't believe, I mean, there is like 24,000 restaurants in New York. There is no place in the world, you know, that it can do that. I mean, because in France, there are, you know, ethnic restaurants, of course, but 99% of French people eat French because that's the way you were born. And so it goes in Italy, of course, and in Spain, and in Belgium, and in Germany. But in America, it doesn't take this way. America is made of people like me, of people of different background, of ethnic group, and that's the reason why someone like me can come to America and, quote, become famous, but on the other hand, a Greek chef can do the same thing, and a Chinese chef can do the same thing, and an Italian chef can do the same thing. It would be very hard in France to do that outside, you know, to permeate that culture of France, or Italy for that matter, or
so let me ask you, since this is called Chef Story, and I hope there's a lot of budding chefs out there listening, if you were a young chef starting out today,
right,
how do you think your career would progress, and where would you go for influence? How would you form yourself?
Well, if you are the luck that I had, and I didn't have a family to feed or anyone else, so you don't worry too much about money. You try to work as much as you can with the greatest chef, and you know who they are from one place or another, to form yourself, and that would go for at least 8-10 years. The point is that you should get into that business for the right reason. And the right reason is that it gratified you, it satisfied you, you love to do that, you love to please people. The food world is a great place to be. There is no political implication in what we do, or racial implication, or religious implication. That's why probably the only thing we can talk about is food now. That's the only thing, you know, politically correct, you know, but it's true. So if you go into that business to, quote, become famous and do a book or a television series, because so many chef are on television now, you're bound to have some profound disappointment, you know, because it may happen, but it's likely that it may not happen. But if you go for the right reason, because you want to do that, it satisfied you, you love it too, it may happen that you become famous too, so much the better. But you have to go in for the right reason, because it's still a difficult world. It's still a work where you work 12, 14 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You still sweat a lot. You still work Saturday and Sunday. You still work holiday. And really, you don't make much money. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start a salary of $12-$14, you know, after you come out of a school, you know, the proper school and all that. So it's still quite low, but for most people, it's satisfying and gratifying.
Mm-hmm. I know when I opened the school 28 years ago, most of the budding chefs that really were on the, you know, track to be the top, all felt every year they had to go to France and do the 3-star Michelin circuit. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's still necessary today?
I really don't think that is still necessary. It's still good to go to another country and experience another lifestyle, whether it's in Italy, in France, and all that. It's not that French cuisine has gone down that much. It's that it was very preeminent before. It's that so many other cuisine have catch up with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I came to America, there was no Italian cuisine, so-called. I mean, even though a third of the population of Italy immigrated in the 30s, you know, in America, so there was a great amount of American and Italian heritage here. But it was Italo-American type of food, meatball too. I mean, the great cuisine of Italy, the great restaurant and all that, people didn't really know that type of cuisine. That, of course, has caught up, and as well as Spanish, as well as Chinese, Japanese, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So French has receded in that sense, that it's not as prominent as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. What's one of the best meals you've had lately that surprised you?
Well, I had a great meal last night at the school. You know, it's always good.
Like gold. Thank you for the plug.
No, but it's true. I mean, the food, it's fresh every day, so it's good. I had some great food last week in Connecticut at my friend with a little bistro called Café Boucher. You know, it's really great, simple, straightforward food. But on the other hand, now we are in May. And it's the time that on the Boston Post Road in Connecticut, the Clam Castle is going to open for the summer. And I'll go there for my, you know, lobster roll, because they use the Philadelphia roll that we used to use at Howard Johnson that you open for hot dog. Uh-huh. He brown it nicely on each side in butter. You have fresh lobster in the center, just with butter, salt, and pepper on top. And, you know, often that's what I discuss with students who want to do extraordinary dishes. I say, just work in depth. You know, often I'm being the devil's advocate. So when I work like at BU, I say, okay, today we're going to do a lobster roll, a BLT, and a hot dog. People say, are you crazy? Yes, there is always a way of doing a better hot dog with a better hot dog, with a better roll, with a better mustard, with a better way of doing it. So that people say, you know what? I had a lobster roll there, or I had a hot dog, or I had a hamburger in that place. That was incredible. It's hard to give that message to the student. They want to work on very flamboyant meal, when in fact, you know, you should work in depth, you know, certain of those dish, you know, a properly roasted chicken. It's not because you did it once that you know how to do it, you know.
A few
hundred times, you know.
You know, Jacques, I don't think you could give a young chef better advice.
Right.
And I see we're running out of time here. I can't thank you enough for being my first guest ever on Chef Story. You are the ultimate Chef Story, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank all our listeners today. And come back next Wednesday at noon. Thanks, Roberta's. Thanks, HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Dorothy.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.